Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Like it or not, you know the slogan.
You have some more.
Once you pump, you can stop. Once you pump, hey, you can stop.
Pulitzer Prize winning journalist Michael Moss confirms it. Once you pop that Pringles can, you really can't stop. In his new book, Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us, he dives into the $1 trillion processed food industry and the science and business behind manufacturing mouth-watering, craveable foods. The book is now out on paperback. Michael Moss, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So you use the phrase bliss point throughout the book. What is the bliss point?
So you have to love the language that this processed food industry uses when they think they're just talking to each other about their efforts to maximize the allure of their products. Salt, they call the flavor burst. Fat, the mouthfeel. Bliss point is the perfect amount of sweetness, not too little, not too much, that describes their efforts to send us over the moon, their products flying off the shelf. I was actually lucky to spend time with the guy who invented the term.
Wow.
A legend in the industry named Howard Moskowitz.
So the bliss point is not just about satisfying a craving and a taste in itself, but actually manufacturing a craving. Tell us more about that.
Well, or engineering in his term. He is trained in experimental psychology from Harvard, responsible for many of the icons in the grocery store. He walked me through his recent creation of a new soda flavor for Dr. Pepper, in which it's an engineering process as he describes it. He started with no less than 59 different formulations of sweetness, each one just slightly different than the others, subjected that to 3,000 consumer taste tests around the country, took the data, threw it in his computer, did his high math regression analysis thing, and out comes these charts of bell-shaped curves like kids get graded on at school, except that the top of the curve is not the dreaded middle C, but the bliss point, the perfect amount of sweetness, not too little, not too much.
For the book, you visited Moskowitz and the Monell Chemical Senses Center. So tell us what that is.
Well, Monell is a center that receives funding both from the government and from the food industry, but its researchers are incredibly independent-minded. They are looking at the basic tastes and our growing dependence, in fact, on processed foods. It was Monell where I learned that we're not even born liking salt. That doesn't develop until about 6 months of age. And they did a recent study showing that kids who are exposed to grocery food, which is inherently typically very salty, are much more apt to be licking the salt shaker by the time they're in pre-K than kids who are fed, you know, whole, natural, fresh vegetables and fruits. And so what that tells us is that the industry is not just responding to our genetic liking for salt in this case, but actually affecting us to develop cravings for us.
I wouldn't imagine the food industry welcoming investigation of how food flavors are engineered to suck people in. How did you gain access to this facility, the Monell Chemical Senses Center, were scientists open to talking to you about their research?
Well, the book is filled with inside documents. I was lucky to come across a trove of them, some 8 million pages that put me at the table of the largest food companies in the country as they're formulating and marketing their products. And it was those documents that enabled me to identify key players in the industry, convince them to talk to me. They opened up and told even more secrets, because one of the surprising things, many of them have come to have substantial regret about their life work. So these are on-the-record interviews of bench chemists and marketing officials and CEOs, basically explaining to me how they did it.
did they talk with you about calculating this bliss point and this mouthfeel and this flavor burst?
No, absolutely, for product after product that I sort of go through in the book. I mean, look, they will argue that they are coming somewhat short of actually encouraging us to overeat, right? Over-consume. And I totally buy into it. I don't see this as this evil industry that intentionally set out to make us overweight or otherwise ill. They are companies doing what companies do, which is to try to make as much money as possible by selling as much product as possible and maximizing the allure of their product. But I have to say, looking at the documents and the interviews, the overwhelming sense you get is that this is an industry that's driving day and night to get us not just to like their products, but to want more and more of them. And that's, of course, where the problem lies. It's not salt, sugar, fat. It's the huge amounts in processed foods and our growing reliance on processed foods.
Michael Moss is with us. We're talking with him about the paperback release of his book, Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. Why did these scientists and food engineers feel regret, do you think? I mean, they may not have set out to hook people, but have they seen how far it's gone and feel culpable?
I open the book with this meeting in 1999 of the CEOs of the largest food companies in North America. It's a very private meeting. They rarely get together, but they have been called together. It's the old Pillsbury headquarters in Minneapolis, Minnesota, to discuss none other than the emerging obesity epidemic. And they've been asked to come and talk about it by none other than people within their own companies, cabals of insiders who had becoming increasingly concerned about their culpability in obesity. And up before them stands one of their own, a senior official from Kraft. He's armed with 114 slides, and he lays at their feet not just culpability for obesity, but diabetes, high blood pressure, heart disease. He even links highly processed foods to several types of cancers, and he pleads with them to collectively start doing something on behalf of consumers to make their products healthier.
Well, so Kraft undertakes this anti-obesity initiative beginning in 2003, a couple of years after that meeting. How has that worked out for them?
Well, here's the problem. And first of all, Kraft does three incredibly amazing things. It decides it's being over-aggressive in marketing its least healthy products to children. It cuts back on that. It decides it's being less than honest with consumers in disclosing calorie loads in snack packages with more than a couple of servings, because their own data showed that many of us will eat the entire package, and if they didn't see the total calorie count, would get not a full sense of how much they're eating. And they also put limits on the amount of salt, sugar, fat that their chemists could add to the products. What happened was that Kraft, because they weren't able to convince the whole industry to join them in this anti-obesity initiative, was acting unilaterally, and they immediately ran into trouble in the cookie aisle, where other companies came in with fatter, richer, bigger cookies, and Kraft felt it had to respond. That's when we started seeing the double stuff Oreo and the triple stuff Oreo and variations on and on and on.
They describe it not only pinpointing the amount of salt and fat and sugar needed to hit this bliss point, not too much, not too little, but also the feeling that those ingredients produce. Like what?
Well, if you ask me, I'm actually more of a salt, fat sort of guy. It's potato chips for me. I mean, look, and in fact, they have all three. Potato chips, if you know, have a good amount of salt. The industry describes that as the flavor burst. They have the fat, right, which is not one of the five basic tastes. It's a feeling that gets picked up by the trigeminal nerve. But just like salt goes right to the reward center of the brain, which sends out those signals of pleasure that encourages to do more. But something I didn't know is that potato chips are also loaded with sugar in the form of the simple potato starch, which gets converted to glucose the second it hits the tongue.
It's all making sense now.
Right, it does. I got cravings talking to these food scientists and listening to their incredibly skillful efforts to maximize the allure.
And as I hear this, you know, scientists fiddling around to make food more craveable, kids high on sugar, big money going into marketing, sounds very familiar. The tobacco industry comes to mind. Do you see a parallel?
Well, there was a parallel. Philip Morris, the largest tobacco company, became the largest food manufacturer starting in the 80s when it bought General Foods and then Kraft. First couple decades of ownership, you see the tobacco managers through the documents doing what you would expect of them. They're nudging, cajoling their food managers to sell more product, even lending them some of their marketing schemes. But in the late 90s, something really surprising happens. Philip Morris gets religion on government intervention. It becomes the first company to embrace government regulation of tobacco. And when they do that, the tobacco managers turn to their food managers and warn them that they're going to have as great or greater problem with salt, sugar, fat, obesity as Philip Morris was having with nicotine and tobacco. Mm-hmm. And they urge the food managers to start reducing their, lowering their dependence on those three ingredients.
Does the food industry operate in that kind of furtive, the shadowy way that the tobacco industry operated in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, knowing that nicotine was addictive, bad for you? You know, I guess I'm getting to, is Big Food actively deceiving the public, Mike?
You know, I think they still argue that food is different from tobacco. There's nothing inherently bad about one potato chip, for example, or generally salt, sugar, fat. It's the amounts and the dependence and perhaps the marketing where things maybe get a little bit different. But from a legal standpoint, the food industry still is convinced that it's on good footing, and it's not, and it can't be compared to tobacco in that sense.
Well, the tobacco industry did come under heavy fire for misleading smokers about the dangers and addictive nature of cigarettes. We all know it's bad. Smoking has dropped dramatically in the past 20 years. Could the same thing happen for processed food?
I think we're at a real tipping point. More and more people are caring about what they're putting into their bodies. They're starting to translate that into purchase decisions. If nothing else, the processed food industry is acutely sensitive to sales drops, and they will respond. They will make truly healthier versions of their products if forced to do it by declining sales.
Michael Moss, thanks for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Michael Moss, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, reporter for The New York Times, and author to the book Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. There's much more on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Beyond the salt, sugar, and fat, processed food also hook you with their colorful packaging and their siren song, the jingle. We asked you for the snack food jingles that got stuck in your head on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. Here are some examples, along with our apologies in advance.
What would you do?
No little cinnamon gum freshens breath longer than Big Red.
So kiss a little longer, stay close a little longer, hold tight a little longer, longer with Big Red.
Oh, I'd love to be an Oscar Mayer wiener. That is what I truly like to be.
Pizza in the morning, pizza in the evening, pizza at supper time. When pizza's on a bagel, you can eat pizza anytime.
Pockets filled with pepperoni pizza or ham and cheese in a crispy pocket.
What are you gonna pick?
Hot Pockets. Double fresh, double good. Come on and double it. Double mint gum.
Up next, a beverage that is so rare and so sought after that it doesn't require a jingle or flashy marketing campaign. Just a lot of legwork and the hand of God.
Until 10 years ago, you could go to the Abbey, except on Friday, because Friday they don't work, because they don't eat. And without problems, you could buy beer. But then the Americans It's all your fault.
I'm sorry.
No, the Americans said Westvleteren is the best beer of the world.
The story of one Trappist Abbey tucked away in the Belgian countryside that continues to brew the highest rated beer in the world, year after year. That's when word of mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. From food scientists manipulating flavors to promote cravings to mega-dollar marketing campaigns, the food industry goes to great lengths to raise profits. What if your bottom line was not about dollars, but devotion? Roman Mars of the 99% Invisible podcast brings us this story of a group of Trappist monks who brew the highest-rated beer in the world, all, in their view, for the glory of God.
Cyrus Farivar is on a mission. He's trying to get a case of beer called Westvleteren.
Westvleteren. I'm not Dutch, so I'm not 100% sure, but I think it's Westvleteren.
It's not easy to get, but apparently it's worth it.
Oh, yes.
If you're a beer nerd or have a friend who's a beer nerd, you've probably heard of Belgian beers. Belgians take their beer very seriously. There are about 200 breweries in a country about twice the size of the Bay Area.
Now, amongst these Belgian breweries and Belgian ales, there's a very specific subtype. Trappist beers. Here's what you need to know about Trappist beers. First, they're amazing. Second, they're made by Trappist monks. These monks trace their roots to a monastery in 17th century France and have since spread out to all over the world.
The main concept behind the Trappist lifestyle is that the abbey should be economically self-sufficient. In other words, the monks should make something and sell it to the public as a way to fund the operations of the abbey itself. Some make cheese, some make spirits. There's even one in Germany that makes lentil soup.
But none of the Trappist products are nearly anywhere as famous as the beer.
But here's the thing about Westvleteren. You can't go there and have as much beer as you want. You can't even have it shipped from the abbey.
If you want to buy beer to take with you, you have to look up the beer reservation phone number on the abbey's website. Then you call this certain phone number during certain hours on certain days. If you're lucky enough to talk to a monk, and yes, you do talk to a monk, to take your reservation, you have to give your license plate number and be available to come pick up your crate during the appointed time that weekend. You're limited to one crate per person, per car, maximum two per car. And you can't buy more than one crate during a 60-day period. Oh, and you agree not to resell the beer as well.
For information, please see our website.
You got that? There is a list of several seemingly arbitrary hoops that you have to jump through if you want to buy this beer. This sort of thing is not unheard of. Velvet ropes and random reward have long been imposed to create artificial scarcity and to heighten demand. But the mainstream trend today seems to be more geared towards greater access and accommodation for customers. The new ideal is that everything is available at all times, no matter where you live. This is the digital age, but clearly, this is not the case for the Westvleteren Trappists. They're trying to make it as difficult as possible.
No. They don't make it difficult. You make it difficult. too much people want this beer.
This is Jeff Van Den Steen. He's the author of a book called Trappist, The Seven Heavenly Beers. And he's even a brewer himself.
Until 10 years ago, you could go to the Abbey, except on Sunday, because then they don't work. And except on Friday, because Friday they don't work, because they don't eat. But Saturday they were open, so you went there, and without problems you could buy beer. Not as much as you want, three crates or two crates. But then the Americans, it's all your fault.
I'm sorry.
No, the Americans said Westvleteren is the best beer of the world. They decided we brew the same amount as the last 40, 50 years. And they have enough of that. So why must they brew more? Because you won't. No. They live between the walls of the Abbey, so for them it's not a problem.
Clearly the Westvleteren Trappists take pride in creating something great that people enjoy. But you, the consumers of beer, are not the real customer. God is.
The head of the abbey says on their website, "We are not brewers. We are monks. We brew beer to be able to afford being monks."
And in that sense, their sometimes frustrating customer service is designed perfectly for the customer they care about most. 99% Invisible was produced this week by Sarus Farivar and me, Roman Mars. It's a project of KALW and the American Institute of Architects, San Francisco. We're distributed by PRX at prx.org.
Stay with us for more on the Monastic Beat. Forget farmers markets, heritage tomato, and home gardens. Monks are the original locavores. We'll speak to the author of A Hermit's Cookbook, Monks, Food, and Fasting in the Middle Ages, when word of mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Today we've been shining a light on the shadowy corners of big food. A little later on, we're going to hear about an investigation of America's meat monopolies. But first, let's look back to a time before food conglomerates and agribusiness, the Middle Ages. What did diets look like back then? To shed some light is Andrew Yotishke, professor of medieval history at Lancaster University. He's author of A Hermit's Cookbook, Monks, Food, and Fasting in the Middle Ages. And since we've been talking about the processed food industry and the abundance of salt and fat and sugar in American diets, we asked him what the early medieval hermits, forerunners of the monks, would have thought of Oreos, Fritos, and Lunchables.
Well, they'd be rather taken aback, I think. They'd certainly be bewildered by the variety of different kind of foods available to us today. And they'd be bewildered also by the different taste sensations and the richness of different tastes. The principle of eating for early medieval hermits and monks was simplicity. And that meant not only choosing foods that grew abundantly and could be easily collected or easily grown. It also meant making sure that the food that you ate tasted as close as possible to what was regarded as its natural or original taste.
So if you were a wayward pilgrim stopping in at a monastery and were able to share a meal, what might that meal look like?
Medieval eating is not like the way we eat today, in that they don't necessarily serve courses in what are called removes. So they would have a lot of different kinds of foods out on the table at the same time, which is closer actually to the way that people eat in the Far East. So you'd have a table laid with different dishes, and you'd take your pick from them. There would certainly be in a monastery guest house in the later Middle Ages, there would be meat dishes. Sometimes roast meat, sometimes game, sometimes meat made with the entrails of meat, which is very common. There would be pies and pastries. And we know that medieval people were very fond of pastries filled with meat and vegetables. There would be locally grown vegetables and herbs. There would be beans. There would be fresh fruit. And if you were lucky, there would then be desserts made with dairy products, eggs and fruit in various kind of combinations, blancmanges, trifles, and so on.
Andrew, your book, A Hermit's Cookbook, Monks, Food, and Fasting in the Middle Ages, brings us through the diets of the Eastern mystics and hermits to the monastic orders that grew throughout the Middle Ages. Was their diet similar, or did it vary based on order or region?
Well, it varied based on region more than on order. The Rule of Benedict, which is written in the 6th century, provided a kind of template for both the kinds of foods that should be eaten and the amount of food that should be eaten. But since every monastery was initially self-regulating, it was difficult to assess how much was being eaten or whether the monasteries were actually keeping to that rule. So whereas in the Eastern Mediterranean, olives, dates, figs, and lentils, chickpeas would be the staple of your original hermits and monks. Of course, in the West, in the Middle Ages, we're talking about a different variety of vegetables, much more root vegetables, bread, carbohydrates, and some legumes as well, beans, but more likely to be broad beans or green beans than the sort of pulses that you'd find in the Eastern Mediterranean.
In what cases were St. Benedict's rules relaxed? And by the way, I noticed that he also introduced or allowed wine.
Yes. Well, he introduced or permitted wine because it was safer to drink than water. And it was the sort of standard drink in Italy. And Benedict was Italian. He was writing for largely Italian communities. But of course, in those days, wine was usually drank watered down to some extent, mixed with water. But it was necessary for to make the water safe to drink. An example of how the diet varied is that in the areas of Western Europe where there was extensive wine growing, wine was drunk by monks. But in Northern Europe, certainly in the British Isles, beer was much more common because it was usually locally made throughout the Middle Ages. So medieval monks would always have been making their own beer because they didn't have the technologies to preserve it over long distances.
To what extent did emerging technological changes and trade change the monastic diet?
I think they had a huge impact. I think that what's happening in more or less the period from about 1000 AD to 1200 and beyond is that Europe is undergoing what I think of as a food revolution. And it's a revolution that comes about through, as you say, through technological change, the introduction of things like windmills, of the deep share plough, which means that the growing and processing of food becomes easier, but also through the revival of trade across the Mediterranean. By 1200, we know that Western Europeans are importing spices and foods from the East in quite large quantities. And with those actual commodities, they're also importing techniques of cooking and preparing food. And these are influencing diet all over Western Europe, not only in great secular households, the households of kings and lords, but also the households of bishops and of monasteries. Monks don't want to be left out of the food revolution.
That's interesting. It didn't represent something more worldly that they would want to reject?
Well, perhaps it should have done, but it didn't. And I think one reason why it didn't is because we don't often realize that monasticism in medieval Europe was very much an aristocratic profession. Peasants don't become monks. The people who are living in and working in monasteries tend to be from the upper classes, from the landowning classes. And of course, it's those classes who are benefiting most from the food revolution because they have the wherewithal to eat a richer and more varied diet. So as we see, I think, a greater divide in Europe between what the rich are eating and what the poor are eating, we have to remember that monasteries are part of the rich world rather than the poor world.
Well, Andrew Jotyszki, a pleasure speaking with you today.
And you. Thank you very much for having me.
Andrew Jotyszki is author of A Hermit's Cookbook, Monk's Food and Fasting in the Middle Ages. He's also professor of medieval history at Lancaster University. And we continue our exploration of food by fast-forwarding a millennia to the present, an unflinching look into the modern meat industrial complex when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Christopher Leonard first visited Waldron, Arkansas in 2004 when he was covering national agribusiness for the Associated Press. Waldron looks like many rural towns that were once pillars of the American economy. Breakfast joint, local bank, and a weekly livestock auction populated by ranchers in cowboy hats. But Waldron's small-town economy is just window dressing. He writes that it would cease to exist if not for its true reason for being, Tyson Foods, the nation's biggest meat company. Tyson made a whopping $28 billion between 2010 and 2011, with $780 million in profits that year. Christopher Leonard's new book, The Meat Racket, The Secret Takeover of America's Food Business, profiles the rise of Tyson and other mega food companies that have quietly gained unprecedented control of America's meat market and reshaped the nation's rural economies. Christopher Leonard, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much for having me here.
Now, you write about America's meat business being an outright oligarchy in our nation's heartland. And your book's title, A Secret Takeover of America's Food Business. How did this business evolve under the radar?
Well, I think one key reason it evolved under the radar is that companies like Tyson Foods, which, as you mentioned, is sort of the main firm I profile in this book, but also other big companies like Cargill, Smithfield Foods, these companies are really anchored out in rural America, in small towns that the national press just never visits, and in these communities that are really far away from the view of most consumers. That's where these firms really operate. And to understand Tyson Foods, it really helped to get out to these small towns where it's really the dominant economic force, as you just described. And that's where my inquiry into this company began, sort of looking at Tyson from the bottom up, if you will, in the small towns where it really operates the economy.
Well, people who do get out, granted you are a reporter, went to Waldron, but people didn't want to talk to you. What's at stake for them?
Well, their livelihoods are at stake, and that's exactly right. This was difficult to report because truly there is an atmosphere of fear and intimidation when you've got an economy that's so consolidated as it is in these small towns where Tyson operates. When I went down initially in 2004, I mean, people were afraid to talk to me about Tyson Foods in the safety of their own living rooms. And I spent a lot of time interviewing chicken farmers. And farmer is actually kind of a bad word to describe these people. They're more like industrial meat factory owners. They're people who would borrow maybe $2 million to build a large complex of industrial chicken houses and then sign a contract with Tyson Foods, which would deliver the birds to them to raise. And these farmers were so under the control of Tyson that they were afraid their neighbors would find out if they spoke to a reporter. I mean, the control this company had was shocking to me, and that's really what led me to start reporting on this book, was just the severe power structure I saw in Waldron and other towns. It really almost felt like a feudal system.
That's the way it reads, almost indebted servitude on the part of the farmers. We have the example of Yanita and Jerry Yandell, if I'm saying that properly, who lived steady middle-class lives with their three boys until batch after batch of chickens that they got from Tyson died. Now, what happened to these farmers?
Well, this is really where the book started for me. Tyson Foods has integrated every aspect of chicken production. In other words, on the north end of Waldron, Arkansas, just as in every other big poultry town, there's a giant industrial complex that Tyson owns, which has a slaughterhouse. There's a feed mill in complexes like this, a hatchery where the birds come from, a shipping, a trucking line, a railroad spur that brings in feed. And the farmers, like Jerry and Kenita Yandell, are sort of at the mercy of the quality of chicks that Tyson Foods will deliver to their farm to raise. And what really struck me about Jerry and Kenita Yandell was the fact that they had built a poultry farming business over decades. I mean, they'd been working in this business since they were teenagers. They'd borrowed money. They worked 7 days a week. And over about 30 years, they had built a solid middle-class living in Waldron, Arkansas. They lived in a brick house and owned a couple trucks, which was a sign of affluence in that community at the time. In just a matter of a few months, they were driven out of business. They were wiped out because there was some sort of problem at the hatchery that Tyson Foods operated. It wasn't Jerry and Kenita Yandell's operation, it was Tyson's. Tyson was delivering batches of birds to their farms, and the birds were just dying out en masse. I actually went down to that farm at this time, and Jerry and Kenita, or rather at that time Jerry was out of town, and Kenita was telling me how she would just walk through the barns and pick up thousands and thousands of birds that were dying And Tyson never fully explained to the Yandells what the problem was with these animals, but in the end it really didn't matter. They had to pay a huge mortgage payment on their farm, and because they lost so many birds, they couldn't make that payment on their mortgage, and they had to declare bankruptcy. They lost everything literally in a matter of months through no fault of their own.
And one of their neighbors also had trouble with his chickens. He wanted to get them tested, but he couldn't because the chickens didn't belong to him. They actually belonged to Tyson.
Yes, it was remarkable, and I think it really highlights the nature of the power relationship here. One of their neighbors, Doug Elmore, was really concerned because Tyson Foods was also delivering diseased animals to his farm, and he wanted to test the bird and find out what the problem was, understandably so. But again, Tyson Foods owns the birds the entire time. A chicken farmer never owns the most important asset on their farm, which is the bird. So if Doug Elmore had taken one of these chickens and sent it to the University of Arkansas, for example, to be independently tested for disease, Tyson Foods could have sued him for theft of one of its birds. So he had to surrender a diseased bird to a Tyson field technician who took it back to the company to test. And I guess not surprisingly, the test results were delivered back to him that said it was essentially his fault, that he hadn't been keeping his chicken houses clean enough and that the birds were suffering from ammonia poisoning.
Mm. Well, the chicken market has always been difficult. You write about its history defined by busts and booms pretty much until the 1960s, what you call the beginning of the chickenization of the American diet. Now, how can one company manage to make chicken the nation's most consumed meat? How can that be possible?
It's a pretty remarkable story. Back in the 60s, you know, at that time, it's kind of hard to think of now, but fast food restaurants did not really have much chicken on the menu. This was back before the chicken nugget, back before the chicken tender, back when the idea of eating a chicken sandwich, a chicken patty between two pieces of bread, was kind of an odd thing. Big chains served hamburger. But there was a brilliant entrepreneur in the South, Don Tyson, who realized that through this new system of producing chickens in a factory environment, an industrial system, he could make meat that was far cheaper than beef or pork. And he realized that the cheapness of this meat would make it all but irresistible to fast food chains like McDonald's and Burger King. Don Tyson worked for over a decade to convince McDonald's to put chicken on the menu. He was working their sales team relentlessly. Eventually, really through its own devices, you know, McDonald's decided, yeah, we can't ignore this. And Tyson Foods was one of the first companies to produce the McNugget. And it was so cheap and could be sort of pressed into so many different products, as I said, from like tenders to McNuggets, that soon it became America's most popular meat.
We're talking about the meat racket. That's the title of a new book by Christopher Leonard, and it's a thoroughly and thoughtfully investigated book and report about how our nation's meat production has been taken over by four major companies relatively quickly. Christopher, NPR's Dan Charles recently reported on this contract farming model, which is part of the vertical integration model that you talk about, initiated by Tyson Foods, now followed by just about everybody. Now, here he is in one of his reports introducing Tom Vukina. He's an economist at North Carolina State University. He studied the model and says from an economic point of view, it's brilliant. So here's Dan Charles and then Tom Vukina.
Vukina says contract farming solves problems like how do you make sure workers do a good job even when you can't watch what they do? How do you convince independent contractors to invest in new and better equipment? These are problems that economists have tried to solve with complex theories.
This thing has phenomenal, theoretically correct design features that they actually came up with knowing absolutely nothing about contract theory. It's actually remarkable. I think it's totally mind-boggling.
So there we have an economist praising this contract farming model, the result of which has created efficient production and pretty much cheap meat to Americans for decades, which he argues benefits society as a whole. So what, to your mind, doesn't work about this contract farming model?
Well, I'd like to address two points there, and I'll save one for later, which is the cheapness of chicken. But first of all, I interviewed the people that built this system initially at Tyson Foods, for example, a gentleman named Joe Fred Starr, who was a close advisor of Don Tyson, another man named Jim Blair, who was senior attorney, general counsel at Tyson Foods, worked with Don Tyson for decades. And I think that economist does have something right in that this system was designed to control the farmer in a way that's difficult to do. I mean, Joe Fred Starr told me that back in the 60s, Tyson Foods realized you couldn't really hire somebody to do this job. It's a seven-day-a-week job. It's very tough. You have to be on point around the clock in case something goes wrong in the chicken houses. And these companies realized that if an independent farmer was heavily indebted, they had that motivation to stay on the farm 7 days a week and work on it. And the company made a strategic choice back in the 60s that they were not going to own these farms. Tyson initially experimented with owning the farms, realized it was kind of a crummy investment, and they'd rather leave that on the balance sheet of rural America, and found a group of farmers who were willing to enter contracts like this because, frankly, jobs in agriculture are fewer and more far between today than they were in the past when this company got started. But I really want to address this notion that the industry delivers these wonderful efficiencies to consumers. It's really, in the past, was true. When you look at the inflation-adjusted cost of meat over decades, you see something really interesting. The inflation-adjusted cost of meat fell steadily through the 70s and 80s as we industrialized the system. But, you know, in economics, everything has a cost. And the cost of this upfront savings for meat was that we traded away our competitive meat industry. And in the late 90s, you saw something really interesting start to happen. That cost curve flattened out. And then it started to rise. Today, meat prices are rising sharply. And that's not news to anybody who shops at the grocery store or anybody trying to feed a family on a budget. Meat prices are climbing very sharply. And that is due, in part, to the fact that we've lost competition in this business. History tells us time and again that when you let too few companies gain too much control over a market, they exercise that market power. It's pretty basic. And that's exactly what the meat companies are doing today, and they're keeping prices higher for consumers than prices otherwise would be.
I know for myself, my grocery bill has pretty much doubled since 2008, and I'm not feeding a big family. Is it really up to the consumer to change this system by rejecting these big name foods?
It is totally unreasonable to expect that your average family is going to be able to buy all of their meat from the local farmers market. That's just not a realistic option for people. We've seen this happen repeatedly in the United States, that industries will become very consolidated. It happened 100 years ago. There's a wonderful book by Doris Kearns Goodwin called The Bully Pulpit that records an era like this in history 100 years ago. You know, industries will become highly consolidated. Monopolistic abuses will become widespread. And really what needs to happen is a public policy approach that will help reintroduce competition. I mean, competition is really at the root of capitalism. Transparent markets, open markets, competition that can allow new entrepreneurs to enter the field. That's the lifeblood of capitalism and free markets. That's what makes things work really well. And to do that, sometimes you need an outside hand to steer a market that has been taken over by just a few entities.
Christopher Leonard, I want to thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much for the time.
Christopher Leonard is former national agribusiness reporter for the Associated Press and currently fellow with the New America Foundation. His new book is called The Meat Racket, The Secret Takeover of America's Food Business. And we do have much more on the book, including Tyson's written statement responding to Christopher Leonard's book, and also our full interview with Doris Kearns Goodwin about the bully pulpit, which Christopher mentioned today. All of that is at wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you for joining us today for a look at the industrial food system that so many Americans are dependent upon and hooked on. If you like what you heard, there's much more to listen to at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us and send us your feedback or share your ideas for the program on Facebook and on Twitter. After all, the most fascinating stories tend to travel by word of mouth. Join us for more on Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Zach Nugent,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.